Mark moved quickly along the line that the patrol had laid to guide him through the wire. He stooped to keep contact with the line in his left hand, and he carried the P-14 in his right. He lifted his feet carefully and stepped lightly, trying not to scuff the snow, trying to spread his weight evenly on each foot so as not to break the crust. Yet every time a flare went up, he had to fall face forward and lie still and huddled, a dark blot in the electric glare of light against the sheet of white, screened only by the persistently falling veils of snow. When he scrambled up in the darkness and moved on, he knew he left a disturbed area of snow. Ordinarily, it would not have mattered, for in the barren, shell-churned wilderness of No Man's Land, such light scrabble marks passed unnoticed. But Mark knew that in the first cold light of dawn, an unusual pair of eyes would be scrutinizing every inch of the ground, hunting for just this kind of sign. Suddenly, colder than the icy, snow-laden air against his cheeks, was the deep chill of loneliness, the sense of vulnerability, of being pitted against a skilled and implacable enemy, an invisible, terrifying, efficient adversary who would deliver instant death at the slightest error. The latest flare sank and died, and he scrambled to his feet and blundered to the dark, jagged wall of the ruined farmhouse. He crouched against it and tried to control his breathing, for this newly conceived terror threatened to smother him. It was the first time it had come upon him. Fear, he had known, had lived with it, as his constant companion these last 2 years, but never this terrible, paralyzing terror. When he touched his fingers of his right hand to his ice-cold cheek, he felt the tremble in them, and in sympathy his teeth chattered in a short staccato rhythm. "I can't shoot like this," he thought wildly, clenching his jaw until it ached, and locking his hands together and holding them hard against his groin. "And I can't stay here." The ruin was too obvious a stand to make. It would be the first point the German sniper would study. He had to get out of there, and quickly. Back to the trenches. Suddenly his terror was panic, and he lifted himself to begin the crazed flight back, leaving his rifle propped against the ruined wall. "Bist du da?" a voice whispered softly near him in the darkness. Mark froze instantly. "Ja." The reply was further along the wall, and Mark found the rifle with his left hand settling naturally onto the stock and his right hand curling about the pistol grip, forefinger hooking over the trigger.
"Komm, wir gehen zurück."
Close beside Mark, sensed rather than seen in the darkness, passed a heavily laden figure. Mark swung the rifle to follow him, his thumb on the safety catch, ready to slip it. The German stumbled heavily in the treacherous snowy footing, and the wiring tools he carried clanked together. The man cursed.
"Scheiße! Halt den Mund!"
snapped the other. And they moved on back towards the German line, above them on the crest of the hill. Mark had not expected a wiring detail to be out in this weather. His first thought had been for the German sniper, but now his mind leapt forward at the sudden good fortune. The patrol would lead him through the German wire, and their heavy, blundering tracks would hide his own from the sniper. It was only when he had decided this that he realized with surprise that his panic had passed. His hands were rock steady, and his breathing was deep and slow. He grinned without humor at his own frailty, and moved forward lightly after the German patrol. They were 100 paces beyond the farmhouse when it stopped snowing. Mark felt the slide of dismay in his chest. He had relied heavily on the snow holding, at least until dawn, but he kept on after the patrol. They were moving faster and more confidently as they neared their own lines. 200 yards below the crest, Mark left them to go on alone and began working his way sideways around the slope, groping his way painstakingly through the heavily staked wire, until at last he recognized and reached the stand that he and Fergus had picked out through binoculars the previous afternoon. The main trunk of one of the oaks that had covered the hill had fallen directly down the slope, pulling up a great matted tangle of roots from the soft, high-explosive ploughed earth. Mark crawled among the tangle of roots, selecting the side which would be in deepest shadow from the winter-angled sun. He wriggled in on his belly until he was half-covered by them, but with his head and shoulders able to turn to cover the full curve of the northern slope ahead of him. Now his first concern was to check the P-14 carefully, paying particular attention to the vulnerable, high-mounted, Bisley-type rear sight to make sure that it had not been knocked or misaligned during the journey across No Man's Land. He ate two of the ham sandwiches, drank a few rationed mouthfuls of sweet coffee, and adjusted the woolen scarf over his mouth and nose for warmth and to prevent the steaming of his breath. Then he laid his forehead carefully against the wooden butt of his rifle. He had developed the knack of instant sleep, and while he slept, it snowed again. When Mark woke in the sickly grey light of dawn, he was blanketed by the fine white flakes, careful not to disturb them. He lifted his head slowly and blinked his eyes rapidly to clear them. His fingers were stiff and cold. He worked them steadily in the gloves, forcing warm blood to flow. He had been lucky again. Twice in one night was too much. First the patrol to lead him through the wire, and now this thin white coat of natural camouflage to blend his shape with the tangled roots of the oak. Too much luck. The pendulum must swing. Slowly, the darkness drew back, widening his circle of vision. And as it expanded, so the whole of Mark's existence came to center in those two wide golden brown eyes. They moved quickly in the pattern of search, touching in turn each irregularity and fold, each feature, each object, each contrasting color or texture of snow and mud and earth, each stump of shattered timber or fallen branch, the irregular rim of every shell hole, looking for shadows where they should not have been, seeking the evidence of disturbance beneath the new thin coat of snow, seeking, searching for life, literally for life. The snow stopped again a little before nine, and by noon the sky had lightened and there were holes in the cloud cover. A single watery ray of sun fell and moved like a searchlight across the southern slope of the hill. Right, Cuthbert, let's draw some Hun fire. Fergus had marked each of the German sniper's kills on the trench map the sergeant-major had loaned him. There were two black spots close to each other in the same section of the trench. At those places the parapet was too low for the commanding bulk of the hill that commanded the front line. After five men had been killed at those two spots, the parapet had been raised with sandbags and crudely lettered notices warned the unwary. Keep your head down, sniper at work. The two black spots were only 50 paces apart, and Fergus guessed that the sniper had achieved his successes here by waiting for a victim to pass down the trench. He would get a glimpse of a head in the first gap, and would be aiming into the second gap with his finger on the hair trigger as the man passed it. He explained this to Sean Courtney as he made his preparations, for by this time Sean was so intrigued by the hunt that only a major German offensive would have lured him back to his headquarters. During the morning he had spoken to his aide-de-camp over the field telephone and told them where they could find him in an emergency. "But make sure it's an emergency," he had growled ferociously into the headset. "I'll draw him from south to north," Fergus explained. "That'll force the bloody Hun to turn away from Mark's stand. It'll give the lad an extra second while he swings back towards the ridge." Fergus MacDonald was good with the dummy. Sean had to concede it. He carried it 2 feet higher than natural man height to compensate for the raised parapet, and he gave it a realistic roll of the shoulders, like a hurrying man as he passed it through the first gap. Sean, the young captain and the beefy, red-faced sergeant-major were waiting with a half-dozen other ranks beyond the second gap, watching Fergus come down the boards towards them steadily. Instinctively they all drew breath and held it as he came up to the second gap, all of them tensed with suspense. Up the slope of the hill the Mauser cracked like a bullwhip on the icy air, and the dummy kicked sharply in Fergus MacDonald's hands. Fergus jerked it down out of sight and fell to his knees to examine the neat round hole punched through the papier-mâché head. "Oh, shit," he whispered bitterly. "Oh, shit all over it." "What is it, MacDonald?" "The bloody Hun. Oh, the sodding bastard. MacDonald, he's picked the same stand as my boy." Sean did not understand for a moment. "He's in among the oak trunks. He's sitting right on top of Mark. They picked the same stand. The vicious, stinging discharge of the Mauser was so close, so high and sharp, that for a few seconds afterwards Mark's eardrums buzzed with the mosquito hum of auditory memory. For seconds he was stunned, frozen with the shock of it. The German sniper was somewhere within 20 feet of where he lay. By some freak of coincidence, he had chosen the same point on the slope as Mark. No, it was no freak of coincidence. With the hunter's eye for ground, both men had selected the ideal position for their common purpose, to deliver swift death from hiding. The pendulum of Mark's fortune had swung to the other end of its arc. Mark had not moved in the seconds since the Mauser shot, but every sense was heightened by the adrenaline that sang through his veins, and his heart beat with a force that seemed to reverberate against the cage of his ribs. The German was on his left, higher up the slope, slightly behind his shoulder. The left was his unprotected side, away from the tangled oak roots. He trained his eyes around, without moving his head, and in the periphery of his vision saw another of the fallen oak trunks close by. He did not move for another full minute, watching for the flicker of movement in the corner of his eye. There was nothing, and the silence was awesome and oppressive, until a Spandau fired a short burst a mile or more away down the line. Mark began to turn his head towards the left, as slowly as a chameleon stalking a fly. Gradually the distortion of periphery vision cleared, and he could sweep the whole of the slope above him. The nearest oak trunk had been savaged with shrapnel. All the bark was torn away, and raw chunks of timber ripped from it. It had fallen across a hollow in the earth, forming a bridge, and although the snow had piled up against it, there was a narrow gap between earth and oak. The gap was perhaps 3 inches wide at the centre, and Mark could see reflected light from the snow beyond. At that moment, a minute blur of movement snapped his eyes in his skull. It was a fleeting movement of a mere 1/16 of an inch, but it riveted Mark's attention. He stared for fully 5 seconds before he realized what he was seeing. Beyond the screening end of the oak trunk, the very tip of a Mauser barrel protruded. It had been bound with burlap to break the stark outline and to prevent reflection of light off metal. But the cruel little mouth of the muzzle was uncovered. The German was lying behind the oak log. Like Mark, his right flank protected, facing halfway from Mark, and less than 20 feet separated them. Mark watched the tip of the Mauser barrel for 10 minutes more, and it did not move again. The German had stillness and patience. Once he had reloaded, he had frozen again into that rigour of watchfulness.
"He's so good that there's no way I can clear the shot," Mark thought. "If I move an inch, he'll hear me. And he'll be fast, very fast."
To get a clear shot, Mark would have to move back 20 feet or more, and then he'd be looking directly into the muzzle of the Mauser. A head-on shot, with the German alerted by his movements. Mark knew he could not afford to give away that much advantage, not against an adversary of this caliber. The long, still minutes crawled by without any break in tension. Mike had the illusion that every nerve and sinew of his body was quivering visibly, but in reality the only movement was in the glove of his right hand. The fingers moved steadily in a kneading motion, keeping supple and warm, and the eyes moved in Mark's skull, swivelling slowly back and forth across the battered trunk of the oak, blinking regularly to clear the tears the tension and the icy air induced. "What the hell is happening up there?" Fergus MacDonald fretted nervously, peering into the lens of the periscope that allowed the observer to keep well down below the sandbag parapet. "The boy's pinned down." General Sean Courtney did not remove his own eyes from the other periscope, but swung it slightly, sweeping back and forth across the slope. "Try the Hun with Cuthbert again."
"I don't think he'll fall for it again," Fergus began to protest immediately, looking up with those close-set eyes, rimmed with pink now by the cold and the strain of waiting.
"That's an order, Sergeant."
Sean Courtney's broad forehead wrinkled, and the dark brows drew sharply together, His voice growled like an old lion, and the dark blue eyes snapped. The power and presence of the man in this mood awed even Fergus MacDonald.
Very well, sir, he muttered sulkily, and went to where the dummy was propped against the firing step.